Hi, it's Diane. On My Mind, Amy Coney Barrett appears headed for confirmation. In recent years, Supreme Court nominees have given away very little during their Senate hearings. Amy Coney Barrett was no exception. But her path to the bench was nearly assured even before the hearings began. And now it appears she'll be on the court ahead of the presidential election, something Senate leader Mitch McConnell and President Trump had promised to make happen. So what are we to take away from the hearings? And did Amy Coney Barrett say anything that reveals what kind of justice she'll be? I asked Mary Ziegler, professor at Florida State University College of Law and author of Abortion in America, A Legal History, Roe v. Wade to the Present. Mary, we've just finished a week of confirmation hearings for Amy Coney Barrett. She sure was skilled at not saying very much. What did you learn from her overall?
Again, very little. I think she didn't say much to distance herself from her academic writings or from what we knew or could glean from her from her prior record. And so while it's unpredictable once someone gets on the Supreme Court, they're not really accountable to the people who nominated them or to the political party with which they're aligned. So anything is possible. But the Amy Coney Barrett we saw this week, I think, is much like the one we would have expected, which is to say someone who's probably going to be quite conservative, kind of in the mold of her mentor, Antonin Scalia.
And when you say quite conservative, what do you mean exactly?
Well, I think the reason she was chosen was to be someone who would vote with a conservative bent all the time, right? So a kind of reliable conservative, which in some ways was what Antonin Scalia was as well. Antonin Scalia didn't do that all the time, but he was a consistent conservative. He was kind of an intellectual powerhouse on the court. He was never a swing vote, with a few rare exceptions involving criminal procedure cases. But he's not, in other words, not in the mold of someone like John Roberts. We would be expecting to see John Roberts has emerged as a sort of swing vote on the court. It would be unlikely to see Amy Coney Barrett be a swing vote on many of the court's cases. So someone who would be a kind of reliable vote for the court's right wing.
I would question whether you would accurately assess Justice Roberts as a swing vote all the time. You're suggesting that if Judge Barrett does become Justice Barrett, she would be a definite conservative vote.
I think that's the intention. And I think the intention is for Justice Barrett to be a conservative vote more in the mold of someone like Clarence Thomas, who's not as canny as Chief Justice Roberts, not as invested in the court's legitimacy as Justice Roberts, and therefore less willing to depart from conservative principles for other reasons than Justice Roberts. I think that's the intention in appointing Justice Barrett, or who will be Justice Barrett, as a Freudian slip. But we won't know, of course, until we see her on the bench. But we didn't see anything this week to make it seem like that bet that the Trump administration and the Federalist Society have made will not pay off.
Judge Barrett declined quite frequently to take a stand on what she called contentious public debate. And she talked about the president's power to delay an election, for example. Mm-hmm. What did you make of that?
I think the sympathetic reading was that Judge Barrett was just committed with her whole heart to not answering questions, right? So even really easy questions like, you know, does breakfast come before dinner? She didn't want to answer that either, because then that would open the door to potentially other questions she didn't want to answer. So the idea, I think, if you were being sympathetic to her, would be that she just didn't want to answer anything, even softball questions. But I think that had the effect of making it seem that she thought certain things that should not be contested and should not be hard questions were things that were worth thinking about and might end up before the courts, including the president unilaterally delaying an election. And so that sort of thing, I think, was concerning. Of course, you know, we might be reading too much into it, but it certainly gives one pause.
You wrote earlier that we should pay attention, special attention, to the phrases settled law and stare decisis. Explain why.
So, of course, one of the things everybody wants to know would be whether a Justice Barrett would reverse some of the court's landmark decisions on everything from abortion to the Affordable Care Act to same-sex marriage. And often you'll see senators kind of fishing for information about that. And Justice Barrett used words like precedent and super precedent. And while these things are not particularly clear, you can sort of read between the lines. So one of the things I noticed was that Barrett wouldn't treat Roe v. Wade as super precedent or settled law, even though the Supreme Court has reconsidered and reaffirmed Roe far more, I think, than almost any other precedent. And so Barrett's definition of a super precedent or settled law was one that had sort of stopped being contentious, essentially, when no one was fighting about it anymore. And if that's your definition of settled law, there's almost no settled law, right? I mean, there certainly is no settled law in the context of culture wars. The Supreme Court has failed to settle and will continue to fail to settle our most deeply felt fights. That's almost inevitable. But it does mean that Barrett at least sees as a possibility the reconsideration of Roe v. Wade, the reconsideration of Obergefell versus Hodges, the Supreme Court's same-sex marriage ruling, and potentially a lot more. She wouldn't even really commit to the idea that the court's rulings on contraception were settled law.
What I find hard to understand is, what about her writings in the past, for example, on abortion, on same-sex marriage? What does that tell us? And why cannot those writings be regarded as her positions?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's this, and people debate the extent to which this is a myth, right? But I think judges try, in good faith, to leave their personal beliefs behind when they enter chambers. Now, are they able to do that? In my opinion, not entirely, because there are cases where the law doesn't give you the answers. And then your experiences, your political worldview, your religious beliefs, all of those things will shape how you view ambiguous questions. And so I think Amy Coney Barrett's background, right, with respect to issues like same-sex marriage or abortion, is in large part why she was chosen, right? And it's important to note that her choice was really important. We had a big breakdown in the relationship between social conservatives and legal conservatives this summer. You had Senator Josh Hawley saying the legal conservative movement is dead, saying that social conservatives would stay home and abandon Donald Trump if not given better Supreme Court nominees. So Amy Coney Barrett is in some ways a fulfillment of Trump's promise to, quote unquote, do better when it comes to Supreme Court nominees. And you might ask, well, what makes her different? And I think in part it's her biography, right? The assumption that she's pro-life, she's devoutly Catholic, she seems to live those values, and that she will vote, those values will shape how she votes. So even though all judges, I think, to some degree, sincerely try not to have their personal beliefs shape their jurisprudence, of course they do, which is why, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg didn't retire during Donald Trump's administration, and you won't see, if Joe Biden is elected, Clarence Thomas won't be retiring then either. So her personal views had everything to do with her selection, and we have reason to believe, as is the case with all judges, that they'll make some difference when she's on the bench.
If indeed she is confirmed, and it certainly looks as though she will be, how quickly do you expect a challenge to Roe v. Wade to come before the court?
There's one the court could take as soon as she shows up. So Mississippi has a law banning abortion at 15 weeks. The court has been basically deciding not to decide whether to hear it. So we know now that they will not make a decision one way or another on whether to take that case until both after the election and after, in all likelihood, Amy Coney Barrett joins the court. It's worth being clear that the court doesn't need to be hearing a challenge, for example, to a heartbeat ban to overturn Roe v. Wade. any abortion case the court hears gives them an opportunity to overturn Roe v. Wade. Now, I don't think it's worth saying, I don't think it's going to happen that quickly. And we can talk about how it's likely to happen, but that's the, on a timeline, the soonest we could see something.
People have talked a great deal, especially in the last few years, about public opinion and to what extent public opinion really does affect the outcome of court decisions. If Donald Trump were to lose, would you expect that that, in fact, could affect sitting justices? Because, as we know, 70% of the American public believe Roe v. Wade should stand. So might his defeat affect how sitting justices feel or act on Roe v. Wade?
I think so. I mean, it's certainly possible, I would say, for someone like Chief Justice Roberts, who's concerned, when you say he's concerned with the legacy or institutional legitimacy of the court, you can't understand what that means without thinking about popular opinion, right? And I would probably put Brett Kavanaugh in that category, too, in part because his confirmation hearings were so disastrous. I think he's interested in kind of restoring his reputation as someone who's not a partisan. That doesn't mean I think both of them would probably happily cast a vote to overturn Roe, but how and when that happens and the extent to which they would trigger a backlash, I think would concern both of them. The other variable is not just popular opinion if Joe Biden wins, of course, is the prospect that the composition of the Supreme Court would change. More than in my entire career, we're seeing progressives propose everything from term limits for sitting justices to court packing or adding new members of the court. And so I think that could have an effect, too, because, of course, if to the extent conservative justices have a way they want to see the law change or an agenda, they won't be able to carry that out very easily if there are four or five or however many new liberal justices added to the court. So both of those things might make the court, or at least some members of the court, inclined to proceed more cautiously, whether it comes to Roe or any other kind of major case.
Wouldn't term limits grandfather in those already seated justices?
There are a variety of proposals floating around, but the term limits bill that's been proposed would grandfather in the sitting justices. So that's more of a long-term structural reform project versus adding new justices to the court, which would, of course, be effective immediately and change the kinds of decisions the court would render immediately.
On the issue of Roe v. Wade and Brown v. Board of Education, Amy Klobuchar certainly had a very strong exchange with Judge Barrett. What did you make of that?
Well, I think two things. If Amy Coney Barrett had said Brown v. Board wasn't settled, then we would probably dedicate the entire conversation to that, right? I mean, that's probably the one point of common ground between legal conservatives and progressives and folks in the middle. I think what it suggested to me was that Barrett's view of when a precedent deserves respect doesn't have much to do with whether the Supreme Court has already reaffirmed it, which means, of course, that has consequences for cases like Roe, which have been reaffirmed, and other divisive cases, too. It also means that she seems to pay attention to political controversy in viewing a precedent to be settled, right? So she's saying now legal school segregation is sort of a point of political consensus across the ideological spectrum. Abortion is not, and that means that Roe is unsettled. Again, I don't think that's a particularly tenable definition of settled law because it means that any Supreme Court decision on any matter that's divisive should be up for reconsideration. And if you start following that logic, that would be true of the Supreme Court's decisions on guns. It would be true of the Supreme Court's decisions on campaign finance. And I have a hard time believing that Amy Coney Barrett is seriously going to reconsider Citizens United or the court's Second Amendment cases. And so does that raises the possibility of a potentially kind of selective view of when we care about culture war issues and when we don't, when it comes to settled law that might make the court appear even more partisan than it already does.
Can you once again explain for us settled law? What does that phrase actually mean?
Well, one of the tricky things is it doesn't objectively mean anything. its meaning is contested. And that was what really the exchange between Klobuchar and Barrett animated, right? That they were talking past each other because they meant different things by settled law. The Supreme Court, usually when thinking about settled law, will ask things like, is it workable, right? Meaning, is it coherent? Can judges figure out what it means and apply it? Do people rely on it, right? Have people formed their lives around the expectation that this rule will be around? Have the facts in the world or in the law changed in such a way that this ruling doesn't make sense anymore? That's usually what we think about when we talk about settled law. Barrett seemed to be injecting a new element into it, which was whether or not something is politically and culturally controversial. That's usually not something the Supreme Court talks about, particularly because the Supreme Court shouldn't have to settle our deepest divides and probably cannot. But Barrett's idea of settled law seemed to suggest that when the court intervenes in a divisive dispute and fails to settle it, then that precedent, by definition, is more up for reconsideration. And again, I don't see how you consistently apply that unless you just don't take precedent or respect for precedent that seriously at all.
Well, using your own words, what about the Affordable Care Act and the extent to which it has already affected so many Americans in this country?
Yeah, I mean, there is a case. I mean, of course, one of the things that the hearings brought out very clearly was that the Affordable Care Act is now once again before the Supreme Court. Now, it's not the same legal issue, so the court wouldn't really be overturning precedent necessarily. And so that raises a related question, which is just to what extent should judges care about how their decisions affect real people, even when it isn't about overturning precedent? And Barrett was kind of noncommittal about that. I mean, she said she certainly takes that into account, but it's unclear the extent to which it would matter to her, right? I mean, she says, I take everything into account. So is that a big factor for her, a minor factor? I'm a little less worried about the Affordable Care Act case than I am about, for example, Roe v. Wade. I don't think, contrary to what Democrats were saying, I don't think she was selected to overturn the Affordable Care Act. I don't think that was the reason conservatives or is the reason conservatives are excited about her. And the case on the Affordable Care Act would give conservatives a variety of paths to sort of giving the government a kind of win without invalidating the entire Affordable Care Act. So I would be somewhat surprised if the court did entirely undo the Affordable Care Act as the Trump administration is requesting, even with Barrett on the court. But that outcome is certainly less likely with Barrett on the court than it would be without.
What's the difference in the question that's being raised about the ACA this time from the way it has been raised in the past?
The first time the ACA case came up, it was about whether Congress had the power to pass it at all. And Chief Justice Roberts said, yes, they did, relying on Congress's taxing power, because there's a penalty, of course, that people pay if they don't carry coverage under the individual mandate. Now, Congress subsequently passed a law in 2017 that essentially zeroed out the penalty that you have to pay. And so some of the questions that are there now are whether, if the individual mandate is unconstitutional now, that there's no penalty, is that severable? In other words, can you pull that piece out of the law without the whole thing collapsing? So it's not squarely about, do you think the individual mandate is okay or not? It's about whether the rest of the law, there's an individual mandate question related to, is it okay now that the penalty has been zeroed out? But there are related questions about, for example, coverage for pre-existing conditions. Can that stand if the individual mandate goes? And conservatives, who are generally pretty down on the constitutionality of the individual mandate, have been more lukewarm about the strength of this current challenge. So I think that there's been a sense that some conservatives might not be interested in, or at least as invested in, invalidating the whole law than they were with the first ACA challenge.
But isn't this the point of getting her onto the court very quickly? Even if Donald Trump loses, he has that lame duck period. Again, won't the court's thinking be affected if he loses in regard to not only Roe v. Wade, but the ACA?
I certainly think that's part of it, right? I mean, I think Trump, in particular, I mean, the Trump administration is challenging the entire ACA.
Yes.
And so their goal is still to have the entire ACA invalidated. And so I think having Barrett there before the ACA case is heard is certainly significant. I think the primary motivation for the timing, which Trump has been quite open about, is that he expects a case involving some sort of challenge to the actual vote to go up to the Supreme Court. And he believes that his judges, that his nominees will vote with him. So I think his primary motivation for the timing of this is that, not so much the ACA case. Although I'm sure he's hoping, I'm sure he would like the court to do conservative things on everything else he's doing too. But I think the timing is primarily, at least if you take Trump at his word about the election.
More from Mary Ziegler when we come back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Mary Ziegler. She's professor at Florida State University College of Law. She's author of the book, Abortion in America, A Legal History, Roe v. Wade to the Present. Mary, this whole notion that the Supreme Court is above politics has really been turned on its head, hasn't it?
It has. I mean, I think the Supreme Court has always been political up to a point, right? But I think you can actually track this, right? That Gallup has shown that people are, and it's what's weird that Gallup has shown, and I think the Supreme Court should be aware of this. The Supreme Court is still relatively popular compared to other branches of government. And yet year on year, people's view of the court as a partisan institution, that those views have become more common. And so the court's popularity or legitimacy is quite fragile indeed, right? Because it's managing to kind of bridge this gap between people's perception that the court is partisan and therefore not above the political fray, but also somehow trying to be. So I think the court is political and people are increasingly aware of that.
We go back to Bush v. Gore. And it strikes me that that was one of the most political actions the court has ever taken. Maybe I'm exaggerating. However, she, that is Judge Barrett, did not respond to questions regarding if there were questions about this forthcoming election, would she, as a Supreme Court justice, be ready to recuse herself from any decision of that sort. What did you make of her response?
Well, I think one of the unfortunate things about recusal rules is that they don't really compel people to recuse, even in situations like this where there would either be real impropriety or at least a real impression of impropriety. So her response was very much in keeping with all of her responses, which was to say it was sort of a non-response, right? So again, it may have been simply that she didn't want to open the door to other more pertinent questions, but I thought that was more telling because there's a record number of challenges to the election already this year. There's trackers that keep account of how many lawsuits there are raised by states, raised by the Trump administration.
I mean, 160 of them, I think.
Right. And I mean, the number might have, I was going to say the number, but I checked yesterday and it had gone up and I don't want to be wrong. So, I mean, the probability of some kind of election-related suit ending up, I mean, it's already happening is the right way to put it, right? The Supreme Court already has election cases that it's acting on. And something more akin to Bush v. Gore is certainly not out of the question when President Trump has more or less said that any result that is not him winning, which seems relatively unlikely given the polls, is an illegitimate one. And so that response to me was more troubling or more indicative because this is not you know, the president unilaterally suspending the election could happen, right? But the challenges to the veracity of the election results are happening. Like, it's not a hypothetical anymore. It's a reality. And so, unfortunately, though, our recusal rules don't give us a lot of tools for demanding much, right? They leave a lot to judges' discretion, and they require a consideration of lots of different factors. So the kind of impropriety it would seemingly create is just one of the variables judges consider when deciding to recuse, which is, I think, unfortunate in this situation. Really, the only constraint there is, which has been a significant one for someone like Chief Justice John Roberts, is appearances, right? I mean, Amy Coney Barrett might not want to be viewed as a judge who hands the election to Donald Trump for her own reasons, even if we don't have as many institutional constraints stopping her from doing that.
I'm interested that you use the word impropriety. Explain what you mean there and how you're using it.
Well, I think Donald Trump has said, right, I mean, or suggested strongly that the reason he wants Amy Coney Barrett confirmed now rather than in the lame duck session or even after he leaves office is because he expects there to be a challenge to the election and he wants to have a ninth justice present. Now, it's not the most articulate way of putting it, but the assumption you make in hearing that is that he expects Amy Coney Barrett to vote that he won the election when that question arrives before the Supreme Court. That almost inevitably would make some kind of ruling by Amy Coney Barrett on that question appear political, right? I mean, he's said she's going to do what I want, and that's why I put her there. Of course, she could not do what he wanted or do what he wanted, but not for the reasons that he's suggesting. But it makes it very hard for her to appear not to be a stooge. I mean, that isn't necessarily what would be going through her mind. But President Trump has put her in a very unenviable position if she's interested in looking like a jurist and not a partisan by making these kinds of predictions and public statements. And so, I mean, I can say if I were her and I were interested in cultivating my legacy, I would recuse myself because I think any kind of outcome for her other than that would potentially damage her standing and her credibility in the longer term.
And, of course, if she were to recuse herself, that would absolutely infuriate President Trump, who, as you say, appointed her because he wanted her vote in his favor if there is a problem with the election.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the other benefits to President Trump in appointing her would be to kind of energize social conservatives who had become disillusioned with Trump after the Supreme Court this summer recognized rights under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act for LGBT employees, and after the court struck down an abortion restriction, social conservatives were sort of throwing up their hands with Trump. So it's a get-out-the-vote tool as well. But to your point, that would be just as applicable, maybe more applicable, right, if the confirmation were to happen in the lame duck session, or even after that, if Trump was saying, I will give you this justice, but only if I win. So what really the timing matters most for is the election. Everything else is more just a function of nominating her at all, but not necessarily when she's confirmed.
Do you have any doubt whatsoever but that she'll be confirmed?
No.
No?
No. I mean, there would have to be some kind of, I mean, the votes seem to be there. I mean, you never know, right? But I mean, it would require some kind of, you know, October surprise that none of us see coming at this point.
You never know. What has she said about same-sex couples and their right to marry?
I don't think she herself has said much, in part because I thought that that issue was more settled, notwithstanding objections to it. So we have reasons to believe because of, for example, she was a member of a school board as recently as 2017 that didn't admit students whose parents were unmarried. So we had reasons to believe that she was quite conservative on issues of sexuality, including but not limited to same-sex couples. Of course, her definition of settled law, though, would definitely mean that the Supreme Court's ruling on same-sex marriage, Obergefell versus Hodges, wouldn't qualify as settled law by her definition. Because, of course, that issue is still a controversial one. And there are lots of, not necessarily challenges to that ruling itself, but related arguments involving usually religious business owners refusing to serve same-sex couples. So again, we don't have the same, we have a little bit of a track record of hers as a judge on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals when it comes to abortion. We don't have as much of one when it comes to same-sex marriage. So here we're mostly drawing on inferences from, you know, her faith and her personal background more than we, and her definition of settled law more than we be on her actual record on the bench.
And what about gun rights? She acknowledged that she does own a gun.
Yeah, her decisions on gun rights were, I think, some of the most attention-getting during the hearing. She, for example, in one opinion of hers, suggested that felons under the Second Amendment had a right to own firearms unless the felony they committed was a dangerous felony. And I think this was striking to some commentators because this is not a view universally held even by conservatives or by originalists who are conservatives. They would, for example, Antonin Scalia, her mentor in the Heller case, which gave rise to the idea of an individual right to bear arms, also said that as examples of limits you could place on that individual right, he said limiting gun ownership for the mentally ill and for felons would be something that would be permissible as a matter of law and as a matter of original intent. And Amy Coney Barrett didn't seem to share that view, at least for certain classes of felon. And so what that tells you in all likelihood is that she is not just going to be a voice for gun rights on the court, but probably to the extreme right end of the spectrum on that issue.
To the extreme right end, what does that mean ultimately?
Meaning that we know very little about where the Supreme Court is going to go on guns, right? We haven't, all we know is that you can't stop people from having a gun in the home. That's it. The Supreme Court has never weighed in on other gun regulations at all. And so that leaves lots of ranges of options for the Supreme Court's conservative members about which gun regulations are okay and about how closely courts should scrutinize any gun regulation. And there are going to be some conservatives who are kind of Second Amendment absolutists who are concerned about any gun regulation. And there might be others who are certainly protective of gun rights but will allow for certain reasonable regulations. And if Amy Coney Barrett is breaking from her mentor on some of the examples he said were the most obvious regulations that were okay under the Second Amendment, that would make you think she was a Second Amendment absolutist and would be disinclined to uphold most, if any, gun regulations.
So what do you think her rise to the court could mean for the court in the long run?
Well, I think if she is what the president and her supporters expect her to be, it will mean the possibility of a court that is much more aggressively and vocally conservative than the one we have now.
And what could that mean?
I think it would mean potentially rulings that are more obviously and easily to understand to be conservative, right? We were speaking earlier about John Roberts, who is very much a conservative, but he's also a crafty conservative who will write opinions that are conservative in a way that the public doesn't understand to be either that far right or really to have done that much. I think Barrett is more likely to be someone like Clarence Thomas, who makes no apologies for what she's doing and frames it as a matter of principle, which means, for example, outcomes that are more likely, including things like the overturning of Roe or the overturning of the ACA or the overturning of Obergefell, in a way that the public could understand and appreciate without needing to talk to somebody like me first, right? Like if John Roberts is the one defining what you're doing, you will often need an expert to come on and say, what just happened here? I think Barrett will create a kind, or help to create a kind of faction on the court to press for more direct, more rapid, more conservative change. Now, whether that happens immediately, I think remains to be seen, because we still have folks like Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch who might be happy to go along with Justices Thomas and Barrett on that journey, or who might not, right? And we don't ultimately even know if Justice Barrett is going to align with someone like Thomas or be concerned about her legacy like Roberts is. But I think it increases the odds of the court being conservative in a really eye-catching and aggressive way. Now, what does that mean for the court? I think that means that the possibility of backlash is much more real. I mean, we already have on the court a big Republican supermajority, even though Democrats have won almost every popular election with the exception of 2004 for decades, which means that you are going to have a court that is increasingly out of step with public opinion and potentially a conservative faction on the court that doesn't care. So the threat of backlash, the threat of things like court packing would increase with that kind of court, I think, than a court that's conservative but also careful, like one led by the Chief Justice.
So is court packing the answer?
I'm not a fan of court packing because, Mark Tushnet at Harvard puts it, it leads to a downward spiral. Like, if the Democrats pack the court, obviously Mitch McConnell is going to have no qualms about packing the court. And so I don't see where that logically ends. If the court, you know, being the size of the Senate or something, I mean, I just don't know. It makes the court into a partisan institution in a way that might be unimaginable to us during this conversation. I think term limits are a better idea, in part because part of what's incongruous is how long justices can stay on the bench after their views don't line up with popular opinion. So if Amy Coney Barrett sits on the bench until she's 87, which was when we lost Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, it will be 2059. Now, maybe in 2016, people wanted Supreme Court justices picked by Donald Trump, but it seems unreasonable to expect that they would want that in 2059. So term limits seem to me to be a better way of giving the court some protection. Of course, we don't want them to be elected. Then they would be even more partisan, too. Giving them some insulation from popular pressure, while at the same time recognizing that they're lifetime appointments. So any sense that people were voting for a specific person to put people on the Supreme Court stops making sense 15, 20, 30, 40, 50 years after the fact. And so I think the gap we see now between popular will and the Supreme Court would potentially close a little bit if we had some kind of term limit.
What would need to happen for the court to become a less political institution?
That's hard to say. I mean, I think the threat of backlash and the threat of court packing have historically made the court a less partisan institution. Because I think the justices who are cynics don't want to lose their power, and the justices who are not cynics don't want to be viewed as cynics. So sometimes historically, I mean, you're probably familiar, Diane, with the famous switch in time that saves nine, which was during the FDR administration, there was a similar situation, right? You had a Supreme Court that was out of step with popular opinion. You had a threat of court packing from Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And the court at the 11th hour began upholding New Deal programs. Now, you can say maybe that wasn't just about the threat of court packing, but it's reasonable to assume that that was certainly a relevant factor. And so the kind of best case scenario for making the court less partisan is that some of these conversations we're having make their way back to the justices, and they see that there's something very wrong with how people are understanding their role in our democracy, and they try to act accordingly, right? They try to kind of dial back the temptation to decide things in a more partisan or aggressive way. But I think I'm a lawyer, so I might be naive about this to a point, but I think that there are times when judges are really trying to do the right thing and interpret the law, and we see examples of that. I doubt very much that Neil Gorsuch is a profound believer in LGBT rights, and yet he wrote an opinion this summer holding that Title VII recognized those rights. So I think there's some value in keeping the court and asking the court not to be partisan. But I think sometimes you have to almost have kind of political hardball threats to make that happen.
Finally, she has said she will be a justice in the pattern set by Justice Scalia. I mean, it's so hard in 2020 to think of a justice going on the court saying, I am an originalist. What in God's name does that mean in 2020?
Well, I think originalism, it's actually interesting, Diane Kiss. I think for a long time, originalism was sort of winning the public opinion wars for the court. Living constitutionalism was not popular among voters if you polled people. Liberals were doing originalism, right? There would be fights about, you know, do the framers think you win or I win? And I think one of the side effects of people becoming aware that the court is partisan is skepticism that originalism is somehow not a political project, right? That it's, I think that's growing. I think the problem, of course, is that originalism is not neutral, right? It can't be. I'm a professional historian, right? There is no way that you can get objective answers to what people thought or the original public meaning of text was. And of course, there's an obvious reason why conservatives are attracted to originalism, which is that most of the time, originalism will give you a conservative answer, right? I mean, that's not an accident. So there are people who are attracted to originalism legitimately because they think it's better than the other jurisprudential alternatives. But the more partisan we think the court is, the more difficult it is to listen to hearings with a straight face where someone tells you that originalism is somehow not related to the reasons politically that Amy Coney Barrett was chosen, which of course is not true. So I think part of what's also on the line here is not just the legitimacy of the court, but the legitimacy of projects like originalism, which make claims to be, you know, legal, constitutional projects, not just partisan projects.
Mary, thank you so much. It was great to talk with you.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
That was Mary Ziegler, professor at Florida State University College of Law and author of Abortion in America, A Legal History, Roe v. Wade to the Present. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you'd like me to cover during these very difficult times. Please continue to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Allison Brody, and Sandra Baker. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Please stay safe and wear those masks. I'm Diane Rehn.